From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made during two separate wars, a generation apart with similar lasting impacts. The first came 100 years ago this month, December of 1914. It was the early days of World War I, and on either side of large Flanders Field, the British and the Germans faced each other. A number of French and Belgian soldiers were fighting alongside the British, but already thousands were dead. Snipers looked for heads poking up from trenches, and what the bullets missed, disease was starting to take. Influenza in particular was a devastating disease. That field long but only about 100 yards wide, and there were countless bodies already lying between the enemies. Then with Christmas coming, something happened. The gunfire stopped. The men approached one another, and yes, these enemies at war decided to celebrate Christmas and recognize their common humanity, if only for 48 hours. The truce lasted those 2 days and concluded with the soldiers singing Silent Night together. Sadly, it did not stop the war. It did not stop the killing, but it reminded all of us for generations to come that war is conducted by men who are maybe not so different. 30 years later, 1944, World War II raging across Europe, a small town in Luxembourg had not celebrated Christmas in 4 years, owing to the occupation and ravages of war. But now things were changing, and an American soldier put on a Santa Claus suit. The children of that small town would experience the gifts from Santa once again. The man who played Santa is now 93 years old. He lives in Pittsford, and he will join us in just a few minutes. First, we've received permission to rebroadcast what has become a legendary event. The late, great journalist Walter Cronkite teamed with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir to perform the story of what happened in 1914. Cronkite read the story with the choir occasionally adding song. We can't play the full broadcast of what they called One Silent Night, but we present part of it now. We pick up the story with Cronkite's reading of how the British reacted in 1914, December 23rd, to seeing, across the battlefield, what looked like Christmas trees. The Germans called them Tannenbaums, and on that December 23rd, the Germans placed candles on the trees, hundreds of them. Let's listen to what happened next. And now I'm hearing that we don't have the cut. All right, well, we'll see if we can go ahead and convert the audio there. We'll have it for you perhaps in a minute. I can tell you that we're going to be talking to Richard Brookins, the American from Pittsford, New York, who played Santa Claus in 1944. And again, we're looking at Christmas at war, our common humanity. It was 1944 that the war was at least nearing its conclusion. The Battle of the Bulge was coming. And we know that thousands upon thousands more would die. But an American group led by Richard Brookins decided they wanted to bring Christmas back to that small town in Luxembourg. Their goal was to make sure the children who hadn't had Christmas celebrated in the last 4 years, that they would have something to celebrate. And Richard Brookins put on that Christmas suit, bringing chocolates, candy, and maybe even a few other toys to those kids. He had no idea the impact it would have on that small town, but we now can talk to Richard Brookins. Richard, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, thank you, Evan.
You are a young 93 now, but I imagine what happened in 1944 remains fresh in your memory, does it?
Constantly remains fresh in my memory, in as much as I just came back from there.
Well, for those of us, again, who might not know the story, why don't you take me back to what led up to that? It's 1944, and it was in that town in Luxembourg. Pronounce the name of the town, Wiltz?
It's spelled W-I-L-T-Z. It's pronounced Wiltz. W is a V.
Wiltz. And Wiltz had not had Christmas, essentially, in their town in about 4 years, right?
It's about 4.5 years, I believe.
Okay. And so typically, obviously, culture is a little different country to country, town to town, Richard. But in Wiltz, they liked to celebrate Christmas with St. Nicholas. We call him Santa Claus. They called him St. Nicholas?
St. Nicholas is really a separate day from Christmas. It's December 6th in memory of St. Nicholas, who was a real being back in the third or fourth century.
And for us in the United States, the idea is that Santa comes on Christmas Eve and can deliver gifts. What's the idea in Wiltz, and what was their idea of what St. Nicholas would do for the kids?
Well, St. Nicholas was a patron saint of the children and also of sailors, but he would come out of the night on December 6th and bestow gifts on shoes that were put outside the door and so forth, and he always rode a white horse in mythology. It's similar to our Christmas, only not a sleigh on a rooftop, but a big human being.
A big human being riding a white horse and no hanging stockings, but shoes outside the door?
As shoes outside the door, and back in those dark days, they would fill them with, of all things, coal, because coal was a commodity that was much desired. It was so cold and dark in those days.
We view coal now as the last thing you want to get. But isn't that something, Richard, that, but I also want to understand how you came to play this role, because I know you have admitted over the years that you had some hesitation. Tell me about the events that led up to that.
Well, we'd suffered great losses during a battle of the Hurricane Forest just before this time frame, and our division was pulled off the line and replaced, and we were sent into Luxembourg, and my unit was sent into Wiltz, Luxembourg, as part of the division headquarters, and I was billeted in a house on the main drag, and there were three other fellows in the same place as I was. One of my friends, Harry Stutz, had met a man in the street, a civilian, and found that the time that they spent under the Germans was atrocious in terms of losing their identity as a country. The country was wiped out, and they were replaced with the name of a district of Germany. Their names were changed from their current Luxembourg names to German. For example, if your name was Charles, you became Karl, and so forth. The street names were changed, and all of their culture and all of their normal activities were changed under the Germans. And when they decided to put the young men into the German army, now that they were registered as German, the people rose up, and there was a general strike, not only in Wiltz, but in the rest of Luxembourg. Of course, the Germans, with their direct approach, wouldn't stand any of that. So they put out an edict that 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon at the town square, everyone would show up, and there would be an execution, and they'd literally shoot a mother and father who would not let their son go in the army. Well, that took care of that right away, and they took eventually 46 young men who never returned. I guess they were sent to the Russian front. Anyway, the background that my friend Harry Stutz learned, was of this type of living these people had had for 4.5 years. He also said they were very happy to be liberated, especially by the American soldiers, but they were very unhappy because they had nothing for the children, and St. Nicholas Day was coming on December 6th. So Harry, being a good entrepreneur, said that we ought to have a Christmas party for these kids. We figured that we're talking about a few kids in the area that we were billeted, so we thought that was a good idea. But Harry went farther than that. He talked to the local priest and the nun who had the girls' convent, and they decided they'd have a broader kind of party. So he recruited a bunch of our guys to help out at the party with gathering candy and gum from our GIs, having the cooks and bakers make cookies and donuts for the kids, and it became a broad townwide affair. And he came to me on almost the day that it was to happen, and said, "I'm all set to go with this." And he says, "But I need some help." And I said, "What's that?" I was a little bit upset because he was a good friend of mine. He hadn't asked me to do anything. He said, "I want you to be St. Nicholas." And I demurred and I told him, I said, "No, I don't want to do that. I don't know anything about St. Nicholas, and I don't want to spoil it for the kids. So, no, give me something else." He said, "That's what I need." So he was my friend, and I finally gave in and said, "Okay, but what do I have to do?" Well, all you have to do is pat him on the head, shuck him under the chin, and we'll take care of the rest of it. Now, go on up to the castle and get a costume that the nuns are waiting for you to put on. And I said, costume? I didn't know anything about a costume. So I went up to the castle, and there were two nuns there, and they had the local priest's garments. They had a rope beard, a bishop's mitre, a scepter, and two little angels dressed as, two little girls, rather, dressed as angels with bands around their heads for halos. And they dressed me and were giggling and having a happy time over it. And I'm feeling pretty miserable because now I know I'm going to get razzed by every GI in the area for wearing a sissy outfit. So anyway, I put it on and swallowed my pride and got in the Jeep. And my friend Keith Burton, who was from Buffalo, by the way, drove the Jeep, took me up to the local public school. They brought out all the kids from the classrooms outside in the playground, and they began to recite and sing and put on a show for St. Nick. And I walked around among the kids, patted them on the head, chucked them under the chin, and I got to thinking, this isn't too bad a deal. So I got into the swing of things and moved around a lot and so forth, and we had just a great time there. Gave out candy and goodies, and got back in the Jeep and went to the castle, which then was a girls' school, I guess, a convent. A convent ran it, but it was a girls' school. And we repeated the act with another bunch of kids, and again, the recitations and the skits took place. We went inside the castle, and they finished their routines, and we had a great time. And everybody was happy. The kids' eyes were as big as moons. The nuns were laughing and having a great time. The local priest was happy. All our guys had a good time. They got time off to do this little thing. And it was an extraordinary event, and we just thought it was great and was very satisfied with ourselves. And that's part one of the story.
Well, I know. I know how over the years, you probably had no idea in those moments what would happen over the years. I want to remind our listeners, we're talking to Richard Brookins, now 93 years old, lives here in Pittsford, New York. And Richard, in 1944, as World War II was still going on, played St. Nicholas and really helped bring Christmas back for the children in the Luxembourg town of Wiltz that had been occupied, that had not had Christmas for more than 4 years. It really hadn't had a visit from St. Nicholas as they had come to expect, and just a remarkable story. For our listeners who want to perhaps call the program, ask a question, or maybe offer your appreciation for really just a great member of our service members, you can call the program 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, as we talk about Christmas and war. Now, Richard, before we move ahead, let me briefly say that you clearly wanted to make sure that you weren't making a mistake with the traditions. I think that, to me, that's why it sounds like you were hesitant, because you didn't want to make a mistake with a tradition you weren't familiar with. But how quickly did you know that day that it was meaningful to the kids, that it didn't matter if you didn't know every tradition perfectly?
Well, pretty soon I noticed the wonderment in the eyes of these children, because they had been briefed that they were going to see the real St. Nicholas. They didn't know it was an American soldier. That is, the youngest kids didn't. It was well camouflaged with this rope beard and so forth. But I could see that this was a exciting time. I didn't know, really, the full conditions under which this was taking place. I wasn't aware of the culture and so forth, but I could see that this was extraordinary from their viewpoint, so I think that gave me a hitch in my britches, and I kept moving.
Let me take a phone call here, because the story is about to continue in a way that I think even surprised Richard. If he thought it was over in one day, he had no idea. But let me grab a phone call. This is Beth in Brighton. Go ahead, Beth.
Hi, Dick. Good to talk to you. My first husband and I spent time at Rochester Tell together.
Oh.
And you shared all sorts of wonderful albums together. And I hope at some moment XXI takes a look at those wonderful albums. But it is so good to talk to you and hear your voice. And John and I really enjoyed our time together.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you. And at my age, I'm happy to talk to anybody.
Well, hey, I'm not far behind you, but it is just great. And Evan's great to have you on.
Well, it's nice to hear from you, and thanks for calling.
Thanks, Dick.
Beth, thank you so much for the call. And I will tell our listeners that when Richard and I spoke on the phone yesterday, you know, Richard, I'm trying to remember what you told me, Richard. You said, you know, you're new at this whole being old thing, that you're an apprentice old guy, that you're only 93 once. You'd never done this before. And I got a good laugh out of that. You sound just as sharp as ever to me.
Well, it's good to know I'm making some sense anyway.
Wonderful sense. And your memory is still obviously so sharp. But, you know, I have to think that we're going back to 1944. You had gone through this ritual. You knew it was meaningful to the kids in that town. You knew you had done something nice for them in this time of war. But at that point, you probably thought, okay, that was nice. You feel good about it, but you move on. And when did it start to occur to you that this, what had happened then, was going to live on in meaningful ways?
Well, not for a long time, but the most significant thing happened 10 days after that party. The Germans attacked and the Battle of the Bulge began,
yeah.
which started 70 years ago yesterday, really. And I found myself leaving the town, and I felt very bad that we had put on a good demonstration for them and we were leaving them. But the real significance of it came to me about 30 years later when I received a letter from a gentleman named Gene Schweig over there, who at the time had been 17 years old, but he had made up his mind they were not going to forget what happened. And he was having a similar party for 30 years, doing exactly the same thing with, I suppose, additional embellishments. But basically, it was the American Saint Nick being portrayed by a Wilts gentleman, and it was an honor for him to be that saint in that particular period. And for 30 years, they had based their celebration of St. Nicholas Day on that party, which was outstanding and amazing. Didn't know that. I'd forgotten all about it. The war had gone on. I'd finished that. Come home, got married, started a family. And suddenly I was being asked through this man in a letter to come back and be St. Nicholas in 1977 to commemorate the rebuilding of their town 30 years after it had been built. And we returned at that time and found that the influence of what we had done in 44 was something they never forgot. I never realized that we made that much difference, nor did any of the other guys that I was still in touch with realize that at that time. And I became Saint Nick again, only adorned in finer clothing and looked like a real big deal with a fancy beard that I had a beard dresser take care of. So we went on then for several returns at their requests, and the activity just continued to grow and grow, and it's even more significant. I think something close to 1,500 kids get their candy from St. Nicholas in these particular days, and it's a prepared bag of goodies that I'd like to have some of. I've never had a chance to have any of it. But the ceremony goes on, and dignitaries appear. There's people from the American Embassy that come. There's a reenactor group of GIs that emulate my organization at the time, and they are so happy. And I just recently came back from another exposure of that kind of thing, and I feel like a big deal, and I really shouldn't. But in honor of all those guys that work with me who did all the work, I participate in this, and for my own benefit and my family who have enjoyed this information about the old man of the family. In fact, 1994, my wife Virginia, who's passed away, took the whole family 19 of us went over, and those my kids have never forgotten this event, have made friends over the years through the internet and other communication, just as I have, and we feel like we have a second family over there that we have to visit every so often.
My guest is Richard Brookins. And Richard, 70 years ago when this happened, again, you're 93 now, you've been 22, 23 years old. Where you live in Pittsford now. What is the local connection? Where are you originally from?
Well, I was born in Rochester, but I lived some of my married life in Irondequoit. They moved to Pittsford, I don't know, 1985, something like that. Our family is spread around the country. I do have a daughter and a son who still live here in Webster. We're very close, not only by internet, but by telephone and occasional get-togethers. So I'm fortunate with a wonderful family. Well, and they are, I made them as good as St. Nicholas can make them.
Well, Rochester's proud of you. Now, you have written that for soldiers at war, the town of Wiltz, Luxembourg, was a kind of haven. You called it a peaceful mountain town that seemed like paradise. Set the scene for us with that. What are your recollections of what Wiltz was like for soldiers who had been at war?
Well, we came into that village, I remember. It was the first place that I'd been for a long time without guns going off. The war had passed through Luxembourg in early September, and they were back recreating their lives. Schools were open. Shops were open. The church bells were ringing, and it was kind of idyllic compared to what we had been used to. The village was all in one piece. It wasn't until later that the Americans blew it up, taking it back again. But at that time, it had not been damaged. The Germans had not defended it. And it was almost a fairyland of existence for a while compared to what we had been doing all across France and Belgium.
Yeah. And how many times over the years, do you know, how many times have you been back to Wiltz?
Do I know? I got them notched on my belt, this is including the one in 44. It's the eighth time.
And the most recent was when?
This past week.
Oh, boy, this past week. That's really remarkable, Richard. And I'm so moved that they still respond to you in essentially the same way. And so let me ask you what you think about when you look back at what happened in 1944, the relationships you've built over the years, and then you think about, you know, I don't mean to be cliche, but when you think about war and you think about, we're talking about our common humanity this hour, is it amazing to you that in 2014 that mankind is still going to war when it seems that we can grow up in different parts of the globe, but so many of us are not that different?
As long as man is on Earth, I'm convinced if they can't get along, there'll be war. The fact that the United States sees it as an opportunity to help people to reestablish normalcy, whatever it may be, wherever. It's noble work that we do. We suffer from it, no question about it. We lose many, many of our young people. Cemetery outside of Luxembourg City holds two boys, one of whom was my best friend, but their brothers, they lay side by side in the American military cemetery along with 5,076 other boys. That's only one cemetery. I don't understand why it's so hard to get along, even though cultures are different. I don't really know how to answer that, but I feel a lot of waste down through the ages. What's occurring now in a very dangerous world is just, I just can't understand it.
Yeah. Well, you know what, Richard? You remind us what is important with your story. Merry Christmas. Thank you so much for spending some time with us, and your story continues to move people 70 years later. That is remarkable.
So thank you for the opportunity to spread the word. I'm still here. on this side of the grass. Thanks for listening.
You got it, Richard. We'll listen as long as you want to tell these stories. You can come back anytime. That's Richard Brookins, Pittsford, New York, really the remarkable story of an American GI, St. Nicholas, bringing Christmas back to the kids in war-torn Europe in 1944. Now, it was in 1914 that the British were fighting alongside the French and the Belgians early in the days of World War I, and on the other side were the Germans. And that story was told by Walter Cronkite and the Mormon Tabernacle Choir just a few years ago. We've got permission to rebroadcast part of that. And you want to talk about a kind of way that humanity reaches across the battlefield? There were thousands dead on that battlefield when the British noticed that the Germans had started to light Christmas trees, and one of them took a risk to cross that field, hoping that there wouldn't be gunshots. Let's listen to Walter Cronkite and the Mormon Tabernacle Choir tell the story from there.
Across the way, British soldiers took an interest in those lights as they sang together the carols of their youth. Word spread, and heads peeked cautiously over sandbags at the now thousands of Tannenbaums glowing like Christmas stars. Two British officers ventured over to the German line and, against orders, arranged a Christmas truce. But the negotiation was a mere formality by then. Up and down the trenches, men from both sides already had begun crossing the line to join in the celebration. Lieutenant Sir Edward Hulse assaulted the enemy with music. In a letter to his mother, he wrote, "We're going to give the enemy every conceivable song from carols to Tipperary." The Germans responded with a Christmas concert of their own. It was not long before the cold air rang with everything from Good King Wenceslas to Auld Lang Syne. The next 2 days, those tidings continued to spring from the hearts of common men who shared the common bond of Christmas. Further down the line, a German violinist stood atop his parapet, framed against the skeletons of bare trees and shattered fortifications, and delicately perched in this desolate landscape. His cold fingers conveyed the poignant beauty of Handel's Largo. Whatever the spirit of Christmas had been before that hour, it was now, above all, the spirit of hope, of peace. A British war correspondent reported that later the soldiers heard a clear voice singing the beloved French carol, "O Holy Night." The singer, Victor Granier, of the Paris Opera. The night watch must have lifted their eyes toward the heavens as they heard his plaintive call. Christmas Day dawned over the muddy fields, and both sides cautiously picked their way through the barbed wire. Side by side, they buried their dead. A German officer known only as Thomas gave Lieutenant Hulse a Christmas gift, a Victoria Cross and letter which had belonged to an English captain. Lieutenant Hulse responded by giving the German officer his silk scarf. One German retrieved a photograph of himself in uniform and asked his former enemies to post it to his sister in Liverpool. Men who had shot at each other only days before gathered in a sacred service for their fallen brothers. Prayers were offered, and the 23rd Psalm was read. Nineteen-year-old Arthur Pelham Byrne, who hoped to study for the ministry after the war, remembered the Germans formed up on one side, the English on the other, the officers standing in front, every head bared. Yes, I think it is a sight one will never see again. As the Christmas of 1914 drew to a close, soldiers who had sung together, played together, and prayed together returned to their trenches. They must have felt reluctant to let the common ground between them become no man's land again. But even as the darkness fell around them, a lone voice floated across the few yards of earth on which they had stood together. In the true spirit of Christmas, one voice and then another joined in. Soon the whole world seemed to be singing, and for a brief moment, the sound of peace was a carol every soul knew by heart. And that's the way it was one Christmas almost 100 years ago. And that's the way it can be as we embrace the message of that silent, holy night.
That's the voice of Walter Cronkite, legendary journalist, with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir singing alongside him as he tells the story of one silent night that was several years ago. And we're glad to have the permission to rebroadcast part of that, telling the story of Christmas on the battlefield, 100 years ago this month, 1914, near the beginning of World War I, when the Germans and the British, French, and Belgians stopped. Finally, for 2 days, stopped fighting, stopped killing each other, and remembered what the season is supposed to be all about. Short break, and when we come back, we're talking about the decision on fracking. In just minutes ago, we start to break it down for you next, right here on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Just trying to stay with WXXINews.org and follow along on Twitter as we see just this hour, Governor Cuomo and some of his team talking about the decision on fracking. And right now, the answer from New York State is no. New York State is saying no to fracking right now, with many people in the Cuomo administration, it looks like, saying that there are the risks outweigh the benefits, that there are significant questions that remain. And let me welcome Matthew Leonard, who is the editor of the Innovation Trail, and my colleague here, who has been sprinting like many of us have been up and down the hallways today trying to follow this. But Matthew, my read from what I'm seeing online and just in the last half hour or so is that for now, New York State says no to fracking.
Well, yes, and now could be quite a long time because in the new year we'll see the New York State's Department of Environmental Conservation outline a series of legally binding prohibitions that will prevent hydraulic activity related to hydraulic fracturing across the state of New York. So we just sat through a pretty lengthy presentation from the state's health commissioner, Dr. Zucker. You'd remember, Evan, and the listeners too, that there's been a two-year lengthy review of all the existing literature that's out there in the country based on the experiences of the 30 states in the union that have hydraulic fracturing already underway. What Dr. Zucker, who then took over the study from Dr. Shah, the previous health commissioner, some 6 months ago, has spent his time doing is really reviewing all of that literature. And one of the points he made was he really focused a lot on the huge gaps in our understanding of the science of the long-term result effects of hydraulic fracturing. He said that longitudinal studies are the gold standard for understanding these kinds of health impacts, and that on a whole range of indicators, including things like soil, air pollution, and other potential impacts that hydraulic fracturing seems to be flagged for, there just isn't the science in there. And on that basis, he referred to his own practice as a physician and of wanting to err on the side of caution and saying without the absence of science, prevention is the cornerstone of public health policy. And on that basis, he cannot agree, would not recommend that hydraulic fracturing can take place in New York. And the Department of Environmental Conservation is going to put the legislative muscle into that decision.
Now, a couple of things here that I think are all important points. Number one, it's going to surprise some people to hear someone from the Cuomo administration say, we still don't have enough study. But, and frankly, I confess that as a part of the media that has been waiting for a decision, that, yeah, there have been a number of different studies taking place. The message today was, yes, there have been studies, but we need more time. We need a longer view than a 1 year study, a 6 month study, a short term study. And frankly, it sounds like New York State is saying, look, we've got Pennsylvania to our south. We've got 29 other states that allow fracking. We can wait.
Right.
We can find out what a decade looks like, what more time looks like.
Right, exactly. Now, to factor that in as well, that the DEC's Commissioner Joe Martens bookended Dr. Zucker's presentation by talking about the amount of land in New York State that would already be prohibited from having hydraulic fracturing activity happening on it. That would be 61% of more than 61% of the land mass of New York State would already have restrictions placed on it.
Because of home rule?
Because of a whole range of other things. Because of the aquifers, because of the water supplies, because of constitutionally protected areas in the Catskills. There's a whole range of caveats that already exist across the landmass of New York State that would prevent hydraulic fracturing from taking place, leaving only around 37% of the state as a viable site for that. Then you factor in the uncertainties around home rule. That is, to remind listeners, home rule is the ability of town councils that actually have zoning laws, and there's about 125 towns in New York State that don't have any zoning laws at all, if you can believe that. So that would be an even messier prospect. And leaving an incredibly messy and complicated patchwork of local legislation and really affecting the economic viability. So one of the things that both Dr. Zucker and Martens opened in their presentation was just that economically, and particularly with falling gasoline prices, the economics of viable hydraulic fracturing activity is marginal as well, in their opinion.
What an interesting point and an important point, because in so many ways that's been the sort of the battle cry for fracking, that there is economic boom town to be gained.
Right.
And part of the message from the Cuomo administration today is we think that's overplayed.
Right. He's also, and then a nice segue, which is, of course, a reporter, first question out of the gate after when Cuomo started taking questions, was a reporter saying, interesting timing that you're about to now go and do the casino announcements at 2 o'clock this afternoon. And he kind of alluded to the fact that there may be a connection to the need to inject other economic activity other than fracking into the economically stressed parts of the Southern Tier where people had the most to gain. He said that, this is the governor saying, that he said he had visited that area of the state a lot. He never ran into someone who said, quote, I love the idea of fracking, but they're people who are just economically distressed, who can't pay their mortgage and see fracking as really their only economic lifeline. So he himself has already kind of maybe alluded to the fact that that a casino on the Southern Tier would be one of the kinds of strategies that he needs to look at now going forward for increasing economic opportunity for people who are going to be impacted by this negative decision around fracking.
Are you saying this is an interesting layer cake that the state's baking all in one day here?
I think this is very much the kind of, as you know as well, Evan, seeing the kind of strategies that the Cuomo administration can muster sometimes, I think it's quite likely that there's some kind of segue there that we're going to see come through. I think the other thing that was very clear was the kind of tradition of safeguarding natural resources that exists in the state of New York. Joe Martin said, we're a very water-rich state. We're a state with a legacy of protecting natural resources, and that all of that informs their decisions as well. And Dr. Zucker said, you know, I had to ask myself the question, would I live, and my family, would I live in a community that had hydraulic fracturing in it? And he said no, and that was the thing that really guided his decision in his presentation.
Let me also go over a few other points here. And
yep.
this is just the kind of day that Twitter is sort of helpful, because you're seeing mm-hmm. bits and pieces coming up.
Yep.
And again, Cuomo asked an important question: what will be the alternative to fracking for people in areas with no alternative?
Right.
As Matthew Leonard saying, that could set the stage for casino development.
Yep.
But Martins, and again, explain who Martins is, Matthew.
So Joe Martins is the commissioner of the state's Department of Environmental Conservation, and he's been overseeing this long process of what's called the SGEIS, which is a technical study looking at, if hydraulic fracturing went ahead, what sort of restrictions would need to be in place to safeguard the environmental values of the state. And the health commissioner made an interesting point that in all the other states that have had hydraulic fracturing introduced in them, the health board of those states were not involved in the decisions to introduce hydraulic fracturing.
It's going
to
shock some people.
Yeah.
And in some ways, that's the Cuomo administration telling people who may not like the decision, look, we're the only ones who really... So in a way, is this deflecting criticism that says they waited too long? Is this them saying, look, we've been doing the work that other states haven't done?
Right. And I think that's very much the message. I think the governor as well was very much enjoying saying, this is something that had nothing to do with me, right, gentlemen?
he said those words.
He did that. He said, I'm so glad to be excluded from this decision, that this is just something you guys have worked out, right? I had nothing to do with this. And he said, I wish that happened more often.
Does he know the election's already passed?
Right, exactly. Right. So I think that, but yeah, that was a really interesting revelation Dr. Zucker has spoken to all of the, he said he'd spoken to all of the state health commissioners where fracking was underway. So that's a considerable body of phone calls that he's made there. And he looked at, there are a couple of key landmark studies, particularly one in Colorado that looked at a community of 125,000 people and has raised some very serious questions about the potential for birth defects. He said it's not a conclusive study, but there are enough red flags there for me to say that this is enough of a, that we have to err on the side of caution. So he did allude to this kind of mosaic of existing health studies, but he said none of them are convincing enough to be able to provide any certainty that we would be able to safeguard the health of the New York population.
So. If you're just joining us, Matthew Leonard, my colleague from the Innovation Trail, is here as we talk about New York's decision in the last hour to not allow fracking, hydraulic fracturing, horizontal fracturing in New York State, and it could be a long time before that decision gets revisited. This is not the decision that, for example, Joe Morelli and many others of the legislature told me earlier this year on this program that they expected. They expected that because of home rule, that Governor Cuomo would come out after the election and say, we will allow it wherever they want it, and if they don't want it, they don't have to have it.
Right.
That is not what he said today. That is not the decision. The decision is no fracking. And the Cuomo administration is already preparing for lawsuits. I'm reading online here, Matthew, that here's a quote from the governor. I'm sure the people who disagree with this will continue to disagree with this. Another quote from the governor, quote, when you have a side that disagrees with the result, they condemn the process. Always, they will challenge it.
Right. So the people to watch, the agencies to watch will be particularly the Joint Landowners Coalition. This is a statewide entity that represents mainly people who have already committed to signing leases with resource development companies. We would also expect to see possibly IOGO, which is the Oil and Gas Institute here in New York State, an industry advocacy group for oil and gas production. They would likely be involved. And there's been some various resource companies like Lenape, and they talked a lot about the Dryden case, Dr. Martens. People might remember this was Dryden was kind of ground zero for this home rule.
Yes.
Case that was put through the state's courts. And he talked about that as a legal game changer. So it really did set the stage. It introduced a degree of uncertainty into the whole issue that undermined the economic modelling that the industry had been pushing, and really made it, I think, you know, it's money for lawyers, obviously, ongoing. But the Joint Landowners Coalition, I would expect them to really mount actions against the DEC and the Cuomo administration.
Yeah, and for our listeners who don't recall all the details of home rule, the long and the short of it is that you had individual towns or a larger municipality saying, even if fracking is allowed, we're going to pass a resolution, no fracking here. That got challenged in court, and the highest court here said that's okay, that these municipalities could do that. The fracking industry came back. The energy industry said, look, that makes it way too difficult to frack, because if we get a permit to frack, what if next year that town wants to pass a resolution blocking it? This is just going to put gum in the works.
Right.
And so
and the town of Avon, people might remember too, close to Rochester, the town of Avon went through this process exactly where they decided to ban, put a moratorium on fracking. I mean, they didn't say they were never going to have it, but they said on the area of the land that the town has control over, we're not going to allow fracking to go forward, and that was also challenged. So it's something that, even though we think of it more as down in the southern tier, it definitely has ripple effects in communities, you know, close to Rochester.
Our colleague Karen DeWitt tweeted that environmentalists are going to have a whole lot of time on their hands. This is a big win for environmentalists.
Well, they can spend their time talking about the Seneca Lake gas storage that you talked about yesterday. They'll be able to put their energy into that.
And they are, yeah.
But now listen, so the other thing is, don't forget that the impacts of natural gas production in Pennsylvania are still going to have a huge impact on the state, because we've seen the green light for the Constitution pipeline to go. It's 124-mile pipeline that's going to run from the southern tier, from Pennsylvania fracking fields all the way to Schoharie County next to Schenectady. Mm-hmm. You're going to see eminent domain, which is the potential of companies to seize private land for the purposes of putting in gas pipes if people don't want to give up their land. So gas is still going to have a big role to play in the politics of the southern tier and in New York State generally. And one of the issues that Innovation Trails is going to investigate in the new year is a lot of the research around the air pollution impact of these things called compressor plants. So that large natural gas pipelines have these key pieces of infrastructure which are called compressors, and they're enormous kind of plants that create ensure the consistent pressure for natural gas to be pumped through. And there's been some studies that have come out associating the activities of these natural gas compressor plants with health impacts through air pollution. And there's going to be a big expansion of natural gas compressor plants. So that's something else to watch in the heart of kind of our thinking around energy and renewable energy and stuff.
All right. Real briefly before I let you go, Matthew, people are going to want to get more information on WXXINews.org, Innovation Trail. Otherwise, best place to get it?
So we'll update update. We'll put the audio of the decision up on Innovation Trail, cross-post it to WXXR News, and we'll be hearing updates, of course, from Karen DeWitt, our Capital Bureau correspondent, later in the day. And definitely look for follow-up and reaction with industry and environmental sectors, over the rest of the week.
And I think that tomorrow, the first hour of this program will devote to fracking and the casino decisions. But last quick question in 30 seconds, Matthew. Is it possible, and I'm sure it's possible, is it really plausible that 5 years, 10 years from now, New York State's going to be able to look at what fracking's been how fracking has been going on in 30 other states for much longer time, and maybe they decide, okay, now is the time?
It's theoretically possible. I think that the game, the energy industry and the game will have changed in so many other levels. Gas will still be in the ground, but I think the momentum around other kinds of renewable energy and stuff will kind of change the landscape again. So at the moment, people may feel it's just buying time. I think that it's very hard to predict a decade out.
Like a buying time. This doesn't look like punting it for another 6 months a year.
This is not a moratorium saying we're going to run another study. For the foreseeable future, this is what natural gas production is going to look like in New York State. So.
Matthew Leonard and the Innovation Trail team have been doing remarkable work on this. Matthew, it's always great to get caught up. Thank you for the help here.
Pleasure. Thanks for letting me drop in.
All right. Short break. And again, if you're just joining us right here on Connections, big news. The state says no to fracking today. That is going to probably last for the foreseeable future. Could be many years. We'll revisit that tomorrow with more depth, along with the casino decision. Short break, and we come back talking about the way we consume media and the way our habits have changed. Next on Connections.